Hi everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hello everyone, and welcome to Pixels, the show where we talk about video games, and I am Patrick Beja. We are going to be having a big VR extravaganza today. We're going to be talking about my impressions about the PlayStation VR. I will let you know whether or not you, yes, you, should buy it. Spoiler alert, probably not. So there you go. You can stop listening now. You have your answer. With me, though, is Ed Mitchell from 4Players Network, which is the place you work at. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm
nice and early over here. And
yeah, it's nice and early for you. For me, it is the eternal grayness of Mordor, which is Finland, because I'm back in Finland for a little bit. So, you know, it feels like a dreadful morning. Thankfully, though, I can escape to the wonders of a reality that is virtual and can do all sorts of things there. You haven't tried the PlayStation VR, though, so you're going to be the wide-eyed, Luddite that can ask me all the questions that regular people want to ask about VR, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. So we're also going to be talking about the Oculus Connect 3, the conference, the third conference, which I think there was some really interesting stuff in there. And I'm curious to see if you will agree or not. And then we have a weird teaser from Rockstar. I have my impressions on Destiny, Rise of Iron, a bunch of stuff. You can play a pigeon in Battlefield, and it's quite incredible, if you as hard as it is to believe. But let's start with the PlayStation VR. So, of course, PlayStation VR is the PlayStation version of a virtual reality headset available since, I would it's about a week, a little bit less, 5 days or so. I've been using it a lot in those 5 days. It's, as again, everyone knows, a lot cheaper if you include the device you're going to be running it on, a lot cheaper than the other serious VR headsets that we've had so far, the Oculus Rift and the HTC Vive. I think they're sort of in a different category as the mobile headsets, or, you know, the mobile things in which you put your mobile devices, which I don't really even think count all that much. There are a lot of people using them, but because they're so, you know, so cheap, and I wouldn't count them into the realm of what virtual reality is trying to be, or at least not yet. So I've been trying this thing since it came out, and in the beginning, I have to say I was a little bit lukewarm, or I guess as lukewarm as I could have expected to be. The first thing that my first impression was when you open the box, you have so many cables that it is almost discouraging. You know, it might seem funny to say this, but it's true. You have like the cable, you have the little box that you have to connect to your PlayStation via HDMI, and you have to connect it to the power outlet, and you also have to plug it in to the PS4 via USB on top of HDMI. And then you have the HDMI, double HDMI thing that comes out to the, you know, one to the TV, one to the PS4, then the double HDMI thing for the PlayStation VR. And then on the PlayStation VR, you have the headset. I mean, honestly, it felt like this is not consumer ready at this point,
right?
Almost. I mean, it's all very well done, but a lot of people talk about the wife acceptance factor. I think that will not be high given the amount of cables. So that was the first impression, and no one ever speaks about it. But honestly, I think it plays into it when you first want to do it. Then the impression on the headset itself, it's light, a lot lighter than you might expect. The quality, the build quality is good. It feels a little bit toyish, but not in a bad toy quality way. And it's overall, that part of it is I would say acceptable. And the on the technical side, everything about it is acceptable. I think the term I would use to describe the overall headset is competent. And that's what I've been saying on Twitter. I've been talking about this a lot on Twitter. And competent is, I think, the word that encompasses the impressions for this headset the best. It's not an exciting word, you know, it's not ecstatic, it's not super happy, it's not super enthusiastic, but that's what it is. But it works, and it's cheaper than the others, and that definitely shows in the quality of the display and the quality of the images you're going to be displaying on that screen. You see a little bit of screen door effect, just a little bit though. There is a little bit of light that comes through the you know, not the headset itself, but the parts that are supposed to insulate your head from the and your eyes from the light. There's a little bit of an opening there at multiple locations, which let the light through. And that can be a little bit distracting as well. It's not a very wide field of view. You know, you can definitely see on the edges of your eyes, of your vision rather, you can see that the screen stops. So you can see the black parts at the edges. And I think all of this, you know, the resolution, the screen door effect, the light, the all of it might lead you to believe that this is not a good headset. But that is not true. I want to emphasize this. It is competent. It does the job. Absolutely 100% does the job. It's also very comfortable to wear. I'm hearing that it is by far the most comfortable one out of the three big ones. Sorry. So don't believe that all of these knocks against it make it not a good headset. It is just what it needs to be, the minimum it needs to be competent and acceptable. All right. I think that sort of does it for the hardware. I've said it enough.
Do you feel that those the things like the field of view and stuff kind of mess with the experience at all?
You know, I thought it would initially. When you first put it on, you think, oh, you know, I can see the light coming through a little bit, and I can see the screen door effect on the individual pixels a little bit, and so that's what you feel initially. But as soon as it starts, as soon as the experience starts, all of this doesn't matter anymore. All of it fades away. And you're definitely, you know, it's not like all of the games and experiences are awesome, but these elements that you paid attention to before it started, when it, you know, when you have the loading screen and when you have the giant camera, the giant screen in front of your eyes, like cinema mode, which they call for when you're in the PlayStation menu, you think, oh, this is going to be annoying. It is not. You forget all of this. You're focused on the center of the screen. None of it matters. So this is where, you know, the sentiment of it is competent comes from. The second stage, or maybe the third, if you count the forest of cables as the first one, is the fact that these experiences, things like, you know, there's deep sea exploration and stuff like that, these experiences are okay. I mean, you definitely feel like you're into this weird, different place to an extent, you know, when you have the menus and the things like that. You see the 3D, right? It's a very convincing stereoscopic depth perception thing. And then you try the experiences, and it's okay. You're diving in the sea into that cage, and you're going deeper and deeper. But at that point, sort of the you understand that it is an environment that has been created. The quality of the graphics feel a little bit like they're holding it back a little bit, because you know that you're in this cartoony type environment. But from what I've experienced with the more expensive VR headset, like the Rift, it's not like the quality of the graphics on those is so great that it all of a sudden feels photorealistic, right? It's still, I think the big issue with VR is going to be that immersion is so important that anything that breaks it a little bit feels like it is getting us to the, how do you call it? Like the frontier in graphics when something is not...
Uncanny Valley.
Right, there you go. The Uncanny Valley. So it's not just the Uncanny Valley is going to manifest itself at any manifestation of lack of reality. And so that means that, yes, it's true that the PlayStation VR and PlayStation itself, including the PlayStation Pro, I'm sure, once it's out, are not powerful enough to give you a full VR experience, but neither are today's PCs and today's hardware. So it's not like all of a sudden you're going to have an Oculus Rift and the things that were taking you out of the experience a little bit in PSVR are going to be sold, because they're not. It's not powerful enough yet, and none of these things are. And in that sense, again, I hate coming back to the competent thing again. It works. It gives you a VR experience with the PlayStation VR. Diving into the sea, you're looking around, you're seeing, you know, the sea creatures flying, I was going to say, but swimming all around you. You have some that are farther away. You have some that are closer. It gives you that impression that you're diving somewhere. But it's not incredibly, wow, oh my God, this is unbelievable. Or at least it wasn't for me. It was pleasant. It was interesting. But it wasn't the killer VR app.
So how much do you think them like keeping the experience more tame, I guess is a good way of saying it, is because they want to keep the frame rate up? Like, I was wondering how much jitter were you experiencing?
There was no jitter. It is incredibly smooth. It is completely lag-free. When you turn your head, and that is key to the experience of immersion, when you turn your head, it is immediate, like instantaneous. You feel, and that is why you feel you're there. When you turn your head, there is like a fraction of a, you know, hundredth of a second, or maybe 100th of a second. I don't know how much exactly, but it's imperceptible. You know, the delay between the screen actually displaying what it should and when you're moving your head. And that's absolutely key.
Did you ever lose yourself? Did the camera ever lose you? Because I know that camera kind of exists to kind of watch the light beam on the headset itself. And that's some things that people complain about with the Vive and stuff like that.
It at some points, there is a very practical way of resetting it. You just press the options button for a couple of seconds, and it resets the screen or your position in the world. And it works very well with the big cinema screen thing. More than a couple of times, often I would get, for some weird reason, when I was in a game world, not in the menus, but in a game world, the thing would get slightly off center, like it would be at an angle, very slight, maybe 5%. And no matter how much I pressed it, it wouldn't correct it. And I don't know why it did that. But, this is, I think, part of the larger conclusion that we're not there yet, and that I will get to that in a little bit. I also want to talk about the other experiences. The reason I'm talking about the Ocean Descent one is that it's the most serene, easiest, most emblematic of what people think VR should be or VR is going to be used for. It's just you're in an environment, strange, different, that you can go in or be in otherwise, and you're just observing thing, and it's incredible to be there. There are a bunch of other demos and experiences and stuff. Most of them were on the same level. There were a couple of games that were okay-ish. There's a shooting gallery still in the placed VR World application where you get tired holding the gun after literally 5 minutes. You would never play the entire game like this. There's a couple of things. Rigs, which is the esports, like, you know, mm-hmm. you're fighting in a big robot, is ridiculous. I mean, I admittedly, I didn't play long, but it was just because it was the most boring thing ever. Maybe if I give
really?
It more,
wow.
It just didn't do it for me. It was just...
See, I thought Rigs would be the kind of platform selling application, you know?
I think that's what we think when we think of VR in terms of what we already know. And that always happens when, you know, new technology or anything new really comes around. It takes a while to adapt to what the capabilities and the best use cases of that new thing is. And until that is realized, until the developers have figured it out, we're just using it to do what we did before, but in that new environment. And that very, very rarely works. Another example would be the Drive Club VR thing. That, I mean, I tried Battlezone, which you're in a tank, like in a kind of Tron world, and you shoot stuff and you're moving the tank, and it was a little bit, it was okay, but it made me a little bit nauseous. Drive Club VR is puke machine. It is, you know, the second you're already, when you're going straight, it's meh. But the second you take a turn, you feel like you're on a boat that, you know, is going to sink.
Right.
It's immediately, like, it took literally 20 seconds.
You think that's just because you're immersed in this experience and you're not feeling the weight of your body going the way you're expecting it to, like you would do in a car?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. It induces motion sickness in 20 seconds. I even tried, you know, I had hopes for Eve Valkyrie, and you don't really get motion sick quite as much. You do get a little bit, but it's not too bad. But it's also not an amazing, fun experience, at least not for me. And about the motion sickness, you know, I remember when I first started playing FPSs in the, you know, early to mid 90s with Wolfenstein and Doom and all of these, it did make me motion sick after half an hour. Absolutely. And I had to learn, you know, to experience that without getting motion sick. And I think we all did. Many, many of us old timers had that experience who weren't born with all of this. So maybe it will be the same for VR. I really don't think so. That Drive Club VR seems like a horrible idea. And maybe some people don't get motion sick. More power to you. I don't think I would be very adverse to trying this again. And, you know, I was talking about doing old stuff with new tech. I remember one of the things people were chasing when FPSs first started was the 360 degrees motion of freedom. And there was a game called Descent, and Descent 2, there were a couple of games.
Which
did that? Do you remember
that? I played that game at PAX. They're coming out with a new version of it for PS4. Yeah, I didn't play it in VR, but I did play the game itself in PAX. Yeah.
Yeah. So no. Yeah. It's not about VR even. It's about when we started getting the technology to render 3D worlds. We thought, well, we have 3D. Let's do full freedom. Right? And so let's do Descent. But it turned out it wasn't unsuccessful. We were all curious about it, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't work out. And those types of games have not continued. So it's just to illustrate the fact that when you have new technology, you try everything, you see what sticks. And a lot of the things you try initially, just you realize after a while, they're just silly. So up to now, I've described a pretty bleak picture of VR and of the PlayStation VR headset, right? It's pretty clear that I probably hate that thing by now and that I regret spending $500 on it. Well, then something happened. And what happened was Batman Arkham VR.
Mm.
And that was, I think everyone describes VR in terms of when they first had their VR wow moment. And yeah, that was it for me.
Really?
I didn't expect it at all. I was thinking, you know, I bought it. Everyone said, oh, by the way, I also played Thumper, which people said would be an incredible experience. It's a rhythm game. And it was cool. It wasn't, oh my God, this is what VR is for. Same with the kitchen demo from Resident Evil 7. It's fun. It's interesting, but it's not a game yet. Even Rush of Blood, the Until Dawn thing, which is a rail shooter, the shooter things, oh my God. I was like, if you want to see what panic is, when you have the scary clowns coming to you and you have like two shotguns, honestly, maybe I'll keep this for after. Let's get back to Batman VR. So I didn't really know what to expect. People had said it was good. I bought it and first started it. And the first scene is the Batman origin story where you're just sitting there and see your parents get murdered. Spoiler. And already...
Spoiler for every Batman movie ever.
Exactly. And already it feels like you're put in a narrative situation that works better. You're immersed in it. And it takes advantage of what VR does, which is makes you feel like you're there. And you see what's happening, and it's very different from having it happen in a screen in front of you, because you are Bruce, you know, six-year-old Bruce in there, and your parents are there. You can look around, and you feel like you're there. You know, your mother is trying to shield you from what's happening, and she puts your hand, and she's, and then the bad guy brings his face very close to yours. It is much more impactful than anything you can see on a screen at a distance. And then the game starts, and it's the first game I had with the touch controllers, the Move controllers, the PlayStation Move. And that changes everything. I was, first of all, I wasn't sitting down anymore. I was standing up, and I had the touch controllers in my hands, which, as you know, I'm sure, simulate your hands and render your hands in the game. And the fact that you can bring up your hands and see them does incredible things for the immersion. And then you're in Wayne Manor and you have Alfred coming there, and you can, you know, teleport. The mode of movement that works best in VR is not to actually walk places, but you just press a button and be transported somewhere else, because then you don't have the motion sickness at all. And they take advantage of that. And so you have your hands, you can click the trigger. It's very rudimentary. You just have your hand opened or closed in a fist. And if you press the trigger, it closes it in a fist. And if you press the trigger near an object, if you can grab it, it grabs it. Or, you know, there's a globe, a big globe in the manor's hole, and if you bring your head to it, it will spin it. You know, you can spin it. It opens the hand and it touches the globe and you spin it. Right. Same with different items, objects in the room. And you can grab stuff. And so there are postcards or items that you can grab. And you grab the postcard, you bring it to your face, you turn it around, you see what's on the other side, you pass it on your other hand, and that is, you know, I was grinning like a six-year-old. It was like this amazing feeling that it actually works. I feel like I'm in there. I was, you know, standing. I couldn't walk. You know, there's maybe a meter and a half both directions, maybe a meter, you know, a couple of square meters of space you need, a little bit less even. So you can't walk too much, and it's probably a good thing because you don't want to start walking around and bumping into things. But that feeling was absolutely incredible. I mean, I've heard other people say that Batman VR is the best VR experience there is. And it's short. It's about maybe 90 minutes, but $20, for things like this, I would be willing to pay $20. You know, if there were 3 or 4 of those experiences a year, and I'm sure there are going to be more at some point down the line, I would be willing to pay for that PSVR headset.
So do you think that the Arkham experience is enough to pay for? You think it's enough to pay for the entire headset?
No.
Or okay.
Absolutely not. I'm coming back to the initial reaction and advice I had. Should you buy a PSVR? No. If you don't think, you know, if you're wondering about it, then you shouldn't. Because it is not worth it. It's not worth your time and it's not worth your money. What it is worth, however, is an experience that is showing what VR is going to be at some point. It's still incredibly crude hardware. It's incredibly crude software. I was talking about the Uncanny Valley earlier. You know, it's true about the graphics, but it's also true about the interaction. In that Batman thing, you can only pick up a few items. And when you try to pick one up that isn't pickable, it breaks it, you know? And the hands are very crude. We're going to talk about the Oculus Touch in a little bit. That's the starting to fix it, but it's really an explorer, you know, we're at the stage where everyone's exploring the technology, and we need to have consumer devices to develop it. You know, it's not like I'm saying they should keep it in the lab for another 5 years. We're at the stage where we need to have consumer products in order for it to keep developing, but it's not cooked. Absolutely not. It's like people often compare VR to 3D TVs or, you know, motion gaming, things like that. I don't know if a lot of gaming is going to happen in VR, but I can guarantee that 3D TVs and, you know, motion gamings, we all knew, or many of us knew, that they were going to go away very, very quickly. And I was among those people. I really don't think VR is going to go away. It is a not life-changing experience, but it's an experience that you cannot have in any other way and that has value, that brings something to you. So I really think it's here to stay. It's going to evolve. This is, you know, 2, 3, 5 years from now, we're going to look at the hardware, exactly what all of those VR converts are saying. There is some truth to it, if everyone's saying it, right? Those initial hardware sets are going to look ancient and ridiculous, and we're going to think, how can I have ever enjoyed this? And to be fair, we don't enjoy them all that much. We have to look for the fun in them. But when they are lighter, when you can take them off and put them on easily, when there isn't necessarily 3 giant cables coming out of it, you know, all of this, then it will be doing stuff. And when we have controllers that mimic the hands better, it will work better. And those are coming, as we'll see in a minute. But beyond all of this, when you have, you know, the Joker that is standing in front of you in the Bat Computer model, and you can move your head closer to his face and look at his dirty teeth and his eyes following you, and you're, you know, a centimeter away from him, it feels
a little creepy,
very creepy, and like nothing you've ever experienced before. It is something new, different, and definitely valuable. You know, there is at the end of Batman of that Arkham VR thing, I'm not going to say what it is, but I was feeling the feeling that you would feel in that experience when, if it was in a video game, in a traditional video game with a screen, you're outside of it. I was inside it. Like, the feeling of being inside it was very real.
Yeah, one of the things you kind of mentioned it, but one of the things I'm kind of worried about with purchasing a new PlayStation VR or any other headset right now is that, like, in 2 years they're gonna come out with a new version of it, you know. And if I'm gonna drop like upwards to $800 on something. I'm not sure if I want to feel like I need to replace it in 2 years, you know?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the PSVR is less expensive than that, but you absolutely need the Move controllers to have the VR experience.
Okay, well, there you go.
If you only have the controller, then most of it is going to feel... I mean, yes, you're going to get some of it, but I don't think it's the same magic. Having your hands muddled in it is key.
I wonder the Move controllers, whether that's kind of leans credence to the whole like Y factor, what you were talking about earlier. Because like, I mean, my fiance has played a little bit on the PlayStation, but I have to tell her where the button, like she has to look down at her controller whenever I tell her to hit a button sometimes.
Yeah.
and so like, what if she can't look down at her controller, which you can't if you have a big headset on, the experience is going to be lesser for her.
For sure. I mean, they often, that's really fun as well. They model the controller inside the game world.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Yeah. So you can actually look at it in some of the games, you know, when you need it.
Yeah.
So you actually can look at it. So that is kind of fun as well. Huh. It's also part of that magical experience that you have the controller in your hand. When you put it up, you see it in the screen in like this neon rendition and things like that. But the Move controllers are what really sells the experience for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I was playing Rush of Blood, you know, the Until Dawn rail shooter, and the it's on rails, and at some point you have like amusement park attraction roller coaster type thing. That was horrible. It immediately made me motion sick. However, as I was saying, you have two shotguns and you have the clowns coming at you, like the scary clowns and the things that start happening on that weird world. I think I have begun understanding what panic really is. You know, when you actually panic and you just start shooting everywhere, I'm not even scared of clowns. Clowns are fine. I like clowns. But they were rushing to me and I knew I had to shoot them for the game, but it was so I don't know, immersive that I was like shooting everywhere and not even shooting at them. I was like, it's difficult to explain. I was actually panicking. And not panicking in the sense, you know, we don't even need to get into the crap idea. Oh my God, it's going to be so realistic. Kids are going to become crazy. I knew I was in a game. It was just, I knew it was a game, but the effect of that game were more realistic than what I had before. So my reaction was also more genuine, I think. And that was an interesting experience for sure. So anyway, I've been talking for like half an hour, but I really think it deserves it because this is the important step, first step, real first step for VR. And for me, at least, it works. And now what we have to do is wait for more developers to figure it out and give us more experiences like Arkham VR, which I haven't said everything about it, but is absolutely the best I've seen on this platform. And if there's more like this, no brainer. At that point, I would recommend it, even at $400.
Well, cool.
So there you go. That being said, by the way, apparently Sony is making a profit with every PSVR they're selling, which to me, if I'm a little bit conspirational, I would say they're making money instead of subsidizing it and make money on the games later, which means they don't think it's going to, you know, make a lot of money on software later. Or maybe it's just that they can, you know, they're still cheaper than all of the others, so they can afford, you know, that higher price and they can lower it later if they want to. But I don't know. It was interesting to note that they're making money on all of them when usually the console manufacturers lose money. It's a loss leader on the hardware, and then they make money on the software. But, you know, they've already lost a little bit of money on the PlayStation VR for a while. Oh, I'm sorry, on the PlayStation 4. And now it's time to reap the benefits, and there's no reason why they wouldn't. But
I wonder how much of that is just them trying to, I mean, if they can turn a profit, they might as well, right? Like they're already they're the cheapest one on the market. So either they sell it for a huge profit and no one buys it, or they sell it for a little bit of a profit and people still buy it because it's still, and it leaves them open to drop it down, like you said, for sales and price reductions later on. So.
And even beyond that, you know, you made me think of something else. They might not want everyone to buy it now because, again, it's not cooked. It's not ready.
Right.
So they want people who are really into it to buy it so that they're, you know, sort of enthusiastic to begin with.
Some sort of beta test kind of in a little bit as well.
Yeah, it's a small barrier to entry with price and, of course, meaning enthusiasm. No, what? What word am I trying to say?
Enthusiasts?
Something like that. enthusiasm. There you go. You know, if you're already positively predisposed, then you pay the extra price and you're happy anyway, or more likely to be happy than if you're like, you buy it for 200 and then it's crap and you don't like it. So maybe it's a way of gaining it as well.
Welcome to Pixels, where Ed serves as Patrick's dictionary.
Thank you very much. I very You're much welcome. Appreciate it. hey, so why don't you serve as the recounter of the Oculus Connect conference with Mark Zuckerberg, who did a pretty long intro, which I personally loved, but I'm curious to hear what you thought of it and tell us what it was.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. It definitely had the kind of feeling. So I guess I'll start off by kind of explaining what happened. So Mark Zuckerberg came on stage and he showed off this kind of social VR kind of platform, which when Oculus was bought by Facebook so many years ago, it definitely felt like Facebook was making that stride into VR, and they wanted it to be a social platform. So they started off by like calling up two people that were in the Facebook offices, and they all kind of hung out together, and they showed a bunch of different, like, kind of like you said, a little experiences. They showed like one being underwater and one being on Mars and stuff like that, which is obviously really cool. But the really cool thing was that they all were sitting around a table, and you were able to see facial expressions on other people's faces. So I was curious, like, how much of that was just the Oculus. Like, the Oculus, it takes up a good maybe half of your face, but it doesn't cover your mouth and it doesn't cover the top part of your forehead. But somehow they were able to kind of mock out the facial expressions that you were making with the while the Oculus is on your face, and they were able to show people making expressions and people talking and stuff like that. And I don't know how much of that was kind of like behind the scenes demo stuff versus like actually working tech.
They didn't go into it too much, and you're right. It's weird because the representations of the people were very cartoony. So it's not. It wasn't that sold it, but you're right. The facial expressions were, you know, there's some camera face recognition magic happening, and we don't know exactly what it is. But it did work in that when they were amazed, their eyebrows would rise and their eyes would widen and their face would open. And when they were sad, they would droop. And so it did work in that sense, surprisingly well.
It was a little heavy-handed a little bit at times, but I think they're trying to show off the tech and they're excited and they're not actors or anything like that, so it comes off as kind of awkward a little bit. But it was cool. And then one of the really neat things they showed was like they were able to called his wife during the demo on like Facebook Talk or something like that. I don't remember what it's called, but they showed her the video of her in the VR experience, and he was able to like kind of move it around using his hand and stuff like that and show the other people. And then if you looked in from her perspective, she saw him in PlayStation the Oculus kind of VR,
the avatars, like the VR
avatar,
world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, and they were able to,
That's weird.
I thought that was cool.
It's kind of hard to wrap your head around this, honestly, because
without seeing it.
Yeah. it felt natural when you were seeing it, but so right. She was, her actual face was being shown on the voice, on mm-hmm. the face call, and she was seeing the VR world, which he was sending her by moving her image in the room, which was, you know, it was like there was a virtual camera on top right. of her.
So it's like he was holding a phone and he right. was moving it to show his friends, you know, and show the dog and stuff like that, you know.
It was very a very weird thing to experience, but the thing is, you know, the facial expressions absolutely sold it. And the other thing is mm-hmm. the hands and the movement of the hands. That's basically with the touch controller, which has a lot of sensors and buttons to render, mimic, and detect the hands properly, so much so that you actually can point a finger, open your hand, make a fist, like grab stuff. So it's much, much more capable than something like the PlayStation Move or even the Oculus Vive's controller. It really shows your hand moving almost individual with individual fingers. And that also contributed to the immersion immensely, I thought. You know, they were grabbing right. stuff, sending, throwing cards, and right? That to me, the faces and the hands was what was needed to simulate presence.
Yeah, and they didn't show the kind of gamey stuff, you know, where when you lean down, it says the like press X or whatever to do this. So I wonder how much of that will be able to translate into an actual consumer product. But it did seem very natural, the kind of movements. There was no like real jank, and like I said, this was a demo, so you never know what's going on behind the scenes. But it did seem very natural, the movement that they were able to make to flip over those cards to show who had the highest card or whatever.
And you know, when I watched it last week, I was pretty amazed. And then I played with the PlayStation VR things and with the PlayStation Moves, and even with that, it does become incredibly natural. Like, you know that you have to press the trigger to grab something with your hand.
Right.
You integrate it immediately. So I can absolutely believe that it works like that with the much more advanced touch controller, which is going to be $200, by the way. And I was a little bit $200 for the pair. And I was a little bit appalled when I saw the price initially. But now that I have experienced it, I understand the importance of having something that can simulate your hand so well. So Basically, I would be, you know, again, it's all, everything has to move forward. But if the experiences are advanced enough, I would be willing to pay $200 just for the controllers. No problem, because it is so important. I think ultimately we'll need, like, I don't know, some kind of gloves that need to mimic your hand entirely, and that might not be so far away, but you also need something in your hand, I think, to hold it. But
have you ever played this game called One Night Ultimate Werewolf? Have you ever heard of it?
I haven't, no.
It's a board game where you kind of all sit around and everyone has a different role, and depending on the role, you decide whether you want to kill like the villagers or the wolves or stuff like that. And there's a VR version of the game that Ubisoft is putting out. I can't remember exactly what it's called, but the idea is that you're able to sit around a table, an actual table, with other people playing the game, and you're able to kind of figure out whether they're lying or not based on their facial expressions. And I think that something like this can lead to things like that. I mean, we all are gamers. We all have friends that live like halfway across the world and stuff like that, and you don't get to sit down at a table and kind of play board games and stuff like that with them as much. So I wonder if that is the key application to making Oculus so great, and it kind of goes with that social network kind of feel as well as gaming. So it's not just like we care about Skyping each other like we do right now, but we can actually see each other in the world. And if you're able to read facial expressions, you're able to do things like tell people if people are lying about things and stuff like that.
Yeah, it is definitely something that you can see when you see that demo. I absolutely agree. And the extent to which it was convincing, I would really encourage people who are interested in VR to go and watch it. It's, you know, it's the beginning of the presentation. It's about, I don't know, 15 minutes or so. But the thing that really struck me was that by the end of it, you know, he started on stage. It wasn't like a pre-recorded demo. He was on stage. He was seeing all the people watching him in the arena, then went to the Rift, put it on, and he was in that quote-unquote world. And initially, you're like, oh, yeah, so they have the stage behind them, blah, blah, blah. And then you start forgetting, to the point that when they've traveled in lots of different places and done stuff and played cards and all of it, when he takes it off again, you're like, oh, right, he was still on stage. I had forgotten that he was actually physically. It did it to you too, right?
Yeah, they make a emphasis to kind of show that, I think. That
possible, yeah.
The fact that he's able to walk over to the VR, show the VR, and you're able to see what he's seeing, and he just walks right back. It definitely is a little breaking to kind of realize that he was kind of on stage that whole time, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that was, I think, really, really interesting and another glimpse into what the VR future is going to be like, because they made a point of saying that, again, we're not there yet. We need like 16K screens and the kind of computer power that, you know, and super light headsets. It's definitely like 5-10 years away for the actual full potential to be unlocked. But the things I take away, they presented, you know, a couple of other things. There's a prototype of a completely wireless headset, which a bunch of people are working on similar things, but it's codenamed Santa Cruz there. There's a web VR, you know, a framework that they're working on, which is going to make things easier to just, you know, develop and use as a VR user.
It's based off of the React framework in JavaScript, right. And it's supposed to make things easier to kind of develop and interact directly with an API in the back end, and just make it easier, you know.
So basically, just go to a URL and with your headset, and you'll be going into a VR experience. You don't necessarily have to be into that app, quote unquote, type ecosystem. So there were a lot of interesting things, honestly.
Well, one of the things that I didn't want to touch on real quick is they called it auto. Oh crap! I don't remember what it's called. Asynchronous time warp and asynchronous space warp. I don't know if you watched that late in the demo.
Yeah.
But the idea of this is that if a frame gets dropped, and that's one of the leading causes of the motion sickness that we were talking about earlier, if a frame gets dropped, Oculus will kind of inject a frame in there to that's kind of like based off of compositing of the previous frame and maybe prediction, and prediction about where you're going. And they've said that it leads to, it was like 11% before of like kind of dropped frames and problems like that, and the problems those cause, to 0.2% now.
Yeah.
And that kind of promise is really promising. I'm interested to see how it works.
Well, they went even further. I mean, that is something they have been working on for a while. That's asynchronous. It's one of the two, either time warp or space warp.
Time warp was the first one they talked about, where it was just a single drop frame. And then they talked about space warp, which was the idea of being able to like substitute in something that was running at low frames for a long amount of time, right?
Right. So the way that works is that they render 45 frames per second and inject 45 intermediate frames to make the experience smooth, because as many people will know, 90 frames per second is what you need in VR in order to not feel motion sick. If you drop below, it immediately makes you motion sick, and 90 is imperative on an average for most people, but so that's what they need to get. So using that technology to the technology of asynchronous time warp to make asynchronous space warp, which is that doubling of the 45 frames per second, what that means is that you only need a computer or a renderer that is going to render 45 frames per second in order to have a VR experience.
And they went ahead and announced that the minimum specs for Oculus, and the big key thing is that it was an NVIDIA 960 was the or higher was the video card, which is obviously a pretty cheap
much
video
cheaper
card.
The systems are now roughly $500 for Rift ready PC, which brings it closer to the price of a cheaper console. It's still more expensive, especially as consoles are getting cheaper. And
yeah,
you have
get,
to remember,
you get more use out of a computer than you do a console. Yeah,
of course, of course. But at that price, I don't think you're going to get the top VR experience anyway.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but it is very encouraging, and it's going to continue. Right. It's going to people are going to keep and developers are going to keep finding tricks to make things easier. They were mentioning things like the resolution of our vision is really good at the it's a very small angle. It's a very small portion of our field of view. And if you can make sure that you render that portion at maximum resolution and everything else at lower resolution, then your eyes won't see the difference, but you will be able to do it at a much cheaper power budget, 3D-wise. And the thing is, we don't have that technology. Oh, crap. I'm going to go answer my phone. Sorry. That is what happens when you don't put your phone in silence mode. I apologize. Right, you are going to be finding more tricks, and it's going to get better and better. And that trick with the portion of the field of view that should be rendered higher is on the horizon, but we don't have the technology to do it yet. It will happen. And so basically, as with all of those things, as is always the case, it's going to... it's just going to get cheaper and more powerful and all of this. I have no doubt. But again, I think, 3-5 years from now will be when I will probably recommend these kinds of things. Unless all of a sudden the PlayStation VR gets, 10 experiences like Batman. And at that point, I will say go for it. But that was a long VR portion, but it is definitely worth it because it starts now. So I'm sure you guys wanted to hear, you wanted to know what to do. And again, if you didn't already know what to do, then don't buy it. More pieces of information, and I wanted to talk about Destiny Rise of Iron, but I want to talk about this thing first. Have you seen the Rockstar Games teaser?
Yeah, they put it up on Twitter, Facebook, like all over, and it was all over Reddit yesterday.
So,
it's basically just a red rectangle with the Rockstar logo kind of faded away a little bit, and it's very reminiscent of Red Dead Redemption.
Exactly.
There were rumors that Red Dead Redemption 2 was going to be at E3. And then they backed out at the last minute because they couldn't find the time to fit it into the PlayStation.
There was also
press conference.
There was also some people speculated that it was because of an issue of gun violence.
That was the other reason they did that, because it was because of they wanted to kind of tone that down because of the shootings in Orlando that week.
That was what it was.
Yeah.
It's been delayed reportedly, or rumors are, and now they just posted this on a Sunday afternoon at, it was Sunday afternoon my time, but morning US time. And that thing in about 24 hours has gotten over 100,000 retweets and 175,000 likes on Twitter alone. It's the amount of excitement there is for that game is you know, rivaled only, I think, by Half-Life 3, or that is the thing you would need to go to top it. It's pretty amazing. So
I wonder if they're going to just say like, oh, it'll be out in November, or if they're going to give it a little bit more time.
No,
I hope they don't say it'll be out in November.
That would be amazing. I mean, they would sell millions, but they would sell dozens of millions. But I mean, I think, I don't know exactly what it's going to be. I would think that it's, there are two things that are possible: Red Dead Redemption Remaster and Red Dead Redemption 2. I had a number of titles that I proposed for Red Dead Redemption 2. Red Dead Revolution, Red Dead Rendition, Red Dead Reaction, Red Dead Realization, Red Dead Relation. Oh, it, I mean, Red Dead Remission. All of those would make for a great game. The story of a cowboy recovering from a battle with cancer, Red Dead Remission. No?
Mm-hmm.
No? Anyone? Okay. Anyway, so it could be either the remaster. I think it will be both, actually. I think there's going to be a remaster, and the I mean, the second one is pretty much a given now with the amount of rumors in this. And I think they will announce the second one and release very quickly a remaster of the first one to get people to play it and experience it and make a little bit of money as we wait for Redemption 2.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they, I mean, they've already got the backwards compatibility on Xbox One for the first game. So, yeah. Wouldn't be surprised if they do a similar thing.
I mean, if you're going to release
a full remaster.
Yeah. If you're going to announce Red Dead Redemption 2, and you don't release a remaster of the first one, you're really leaving money on the table. That makes no sense, I think. So, I'm really, we don't have any other information. We don't know when they're going to discuss it more. But if you do something like that on Twitter, I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, even by the time this show is a day old, we've heard more from Rockstar, because you don't do this and then do nothing for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You have to announce it. So, Destiny Rise of Iron. I've mentioned that I wanted to play it and that I would give my impressions on the show. Honestly, I'm disappointed. I've loved Destiny so much, and I still do. But Rise of Iron, I've done the story portion and a little bit of missions after that. The story is relatively short, just like the Taken King was, but it's so much less impactful. It's less exciting, it's less funny, it's less well written, and the environment of the Fell Winter, whatever it is, I mean the old Russia portion of the Cosmodrome that we go to for this, feels a lot more like recycled assets, which it is, because it uses the assets of the Cosmodrome, we know, than the Taken King was. The Taken King was, you know, the Dreadnought was a completely new environment. It felt different and new, and the writing was better, all of it. This feels like a cheap season pass expansion type of thing. You know, it's $30, so it's not a full price game, so we shouldn't expect one, but still, it is no, if you were expecting something like The Taken King, it is not. You don't have, you know, new gameplay elements, or very few. You don't have a new spec, you don't have a new, you know, you have one new strike, apparently really good, I haven't played it, but a really good but short raid of three bosses. So it's really for people who have been playing nonstop and who want new stuff. I think those people are probably happy. I have a couple of friends who have, you know, been playing Rise of Iron nonstop for the past few weeks. But for most people, if you weren't still playing Destiny, I think it's safe to wait for Destiny 2 next year and completely pass on Rise of Iron, even if you loved Destiny original and or The Taken King. It is nowhere as good as The Taken King, so don't worry about it too much. There are plenty of great games to play now. I think you can wait for Destiny 2 next year. Gears of War 4. So we haven't played it. But it's apparently exactly what it was going to be. It's more Gears of War, which is good, I guess, and bad at the same time. I think it's, again, for big fans of Gears of War. It's visually striking. Everyone agrees that it's a good Gears of War. But it's, you know, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. So I think depending on how you feel about the franchise and the different games that have come out over the next 10, over the past 10 years, you'll decide for yourself how you feel about Gears of War 4. But I don't think anyone is going to be surprised either way at what it is. So there you go. Have you seen that pigeon gameplay for Battlefield 1 thing?
I saw like an article on it, and I just kind of like glanced at it, but I didn't actually watch a video or anything like that.
I think, you know, I think everyone should. It sounds incredibly dumb to be playing a pigeon in Battlefield 1.
Yeah.
But it's so Battlefield 1, as you know, is set in during World War 1, and this is a short set piece moment of the game where the players or the characters release a pigeon to give coordinates for a strike. And I'm not going to spoil it, but it's basically the value of it is you're in the middle of that incredibly hectic experience of being in fighting in World War One, and then you start, you know, you transition to playing that pigeon who is just flying towards where he wants to go for a little bit, and you get out of the chaos of this war. You're soaring, maybe, I don't know, a 100 meters high or 50 meters high. Yeah. And you see the chaos in below you, and the sound gets muffled and all of this. Huh. And it's incredibly poetic. You know, it has a value of storytelling that has rarely been achieved. I think Modern Warfare and Modern Warfare 2 managed to do that when they would put you in situations where that you didn't expect during that those conflicts. But here it does kind of the same thing in a very different way. And yeah. I think it's as powerful as it sounds ridiculous initially. So I think you should go and at least watch the video if you search for Battlefield 1 Pigeon.
Actually, it looks kind of cool.
Yeah, it definitely is, and I did want to mention it. Another thing that looks kind of cool is the Old Republic Knights of the Eternal Throne trailer, which almost made me go and reactivate my, or, you know, re-download the Old Republic, which is an MMO, as many people know. Have you seen this trailer?
Yeah, I love the Old Republic's trailers. They're I would say maybe not on par with like a Blizzard cinematic, but it definitely is harkens back to that kind of stuff, and just every time I watch it, I'm like you. I feel the need to go and play it again. When the Knights of the Fallen Empire trailer came out, I went back and played it for a little bit.
So, how was it? Did it live up to the expectation of the trailer? Or because I'm still on the verge of re-downloading.
That was the thing. Was like I didn't get to jump right into the Knights of the Fallen Empire stuff. I'm still level 40 or something like that on my highest level character, so I didn't get the full experience. And that's the thing. I feel like the Old Republic is exactly what it was trying to be. It was an MMO that had that each class had its own individual story, and I just wish that the stuff in between the travel and the combat that was to me was so easy to understand because I played WoW, but more difficult than WoW. It wasn't as easy to kill things. I felt like the minute-to-minute gameplay wasn't enough to keep me going. Despite
and it's
the
still
story,
that is what you're is
yeah,
what you're
it still is. It, despite the story, really wanting to keep me going.
That's too bad because that trailer, honestly. Yeah. I think storytelling wise, it's better than some of what Blizzard has been doing, which always has a.
Actually, you know what? It doesn't just remind me of like the Blizzard cinematic because it doesn't have the polish there, but it reminds me of the Overwatch shorts.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's where it has a very compelling story
narrative.
Narrative, and you watch this and you want to find out more, which is the strength of that game, I guess. But
exactly. Yeah.
All right, so that's the Old Republic. I don't think, you know, the thing is there are so many things to play now for this holiday season that I'm not sure I'm going to pull the trigger on that, but maybe, who knows.
Remember, you can play it for free.
Yeah, but
you don't
not
have to subscribe.
Right, but not the Knights of the Eternal Throne. You have to buy it, the latest expansion, sure. As is common, you know, for everything. Yeah. But you know, if you want to try it, there is a movie coming out soon. Is it at the end of the year, the Rogue One, or is it next year?
Yeah, it's late December.
Oh my God!
I think late December is when every single movie is going to come out.
I think they had one planned for April, but then it was pushed.
Episode eight was supposed to be this year, but then they pushed it back.
It's gonna be every year, every holiday.
Yeah. December time, yeah.
Very excited. So yeah, maybe that will make me want to try Knights of the Eternal Throne. Maybe, I don't know. I mean it would be interesting to if you are a listener and you're still playing The Old Republic, please let me know how different it is from what it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago, or maybe even before that, because WoW has some things that change. It's still the same core gameplay, but especially in the latest expansion, a lot of things have changed in the way you approach it. And those things you only experience if you get into the last expansion, right? And maybe in Knights of the Eternal Throne, there are some of those cool new gameplay elements and approaches to what an MMO is today. And if it is, I think I would like to go and experience them. I would be ready to purchase Knights of the Eternal Throne. So if you play it, if you've tried it, please let me know. I'd be curious to have your impressions. That would be awesome. Steam is getting a native PlayStation 4 controller, and the Steam Link system is getting integrated into TVs, some TVs, so you don't need the actual box to do it. You just have like a Steam Link app, I guess, on your TV.
Right.
Both cool elements expanding the reach of Steam. I can't find it now, but I saw a graph of the progression of Steam in over the past 10 years. And the thing is, I think for most of us, we've thought of Steam as this thing that has that arrived maybe in the late 2000s and that's been there ever since, but it's never stopped growing. And it's growing to levels that are pretty amazing nowadays. So, and that's why, because Valve keeps expanding the reach of Steam and the attractability, and they have become a store more than, that makes me sad, and hashtag Half-Life 3, but they've become a store more than a developer of games. So, yeah, it's not good or bad, it's just, that's the way it is. And Steam is great. I love Steam. But anyway, so you'll be able to use your PS4 controllers easily, which is great news. If you want to, you know, use... There are so many games now that use Steam that are not necessarily best played on the keyboard. That's yet, you know, another option. So... we were talking about Gears of War. I forgot to mention it. Apparently, Universal is developing a Gears of War movie. It's not the first time there's been talk about this in the 2000s as well, but now it's looking like it might be happening. I don't know what to think of this. Gears of War is so over the top and silly, you know, bros, like army bros, high-fiving all the time and having those ridiculous banter lines. And the thing is, if they do it faithful to the game, then it's going to look dumb. If they do it unfaithful, then it's not going to look faithful, obviously. So I don't know what to expect.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seemed like the Assassin's Creed movie was going to kind of stay faithful to the series for the most part. So maybe they'll stick with the same thing with Gears of War.
Yeah, but Assassin's Creed faithful to the game, you can see how it would work. It's a serious story. Yeah. With Gears of War, I mean, maybe it would work as a sci-fi army comedy movie. I guess that would be that could be pretty fun actually.
Maybe it'd be like Starship Troopers.
Kind of, yeah, but less ironic and more just it would be more like, you know, the Jude Apatow movies. the because they're so, you know, anyway, it would be more, I would see it more like this, like what's the thing about the thing in Vegas, they made like three or four Vegas movies.
The Hangover movies.
The Hangover, there you go. Yeah. For some reason, Gears of War, and I understand this seems completely unrelated, but Gears of War makes me think of that kind of over-the-top, ridiculous humor in its own way. So maybe that would be an interesting niche genre. But and finally, have you seen this Trump is not a team player thing that's been taking over the internet?
Oh my goodness. It's hilarious.
It's so, okay, I am a pretty political person. We're not going to be talking about the politics of it here, but just the implications. So there's a group which I can't remember. It's a PAC, basically, called readyballot.org that made a site called Trump is Not a Team Player to try and denounce Trump's failings in a way that gamers would understand. And basically what it is it shows, it's a series of cartoons and pieces of text showing how Trump equates to the worst players we see in video games. And specifically, the illustrations are from Overwatch, which immediately grabbed my attention, obviously. a few examples, I'm sure you've seen them, but it says, my team sucks in bold letters. And then it goes on to explain how Trump corresponds to that statement. It says Trump has fired two campaign managers, his policy team quit because he forgot to pay them, and he's being abandoned by the Republican Party. Basically, they're saying Trump is the guy, is like the guy who is on in your games and that always complains about his team.
And is blaming everyone but himself.
Yeah, exactly. Always blaming everyone but himself. The controller is broken is another of those claims. This screen has input delay and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a bunch of other ones. And each time they're illustrated by an Overwatch character. Some people love this. I think I was going to say some people don't. I think everyone has thought it was at least super funny.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
I don't know what to think of this. I think it's funny enough. Whether it's for Trump or Clinton, I guess it's probably an efficient way of talking to people who don't care about politics all that much and who care a lot about video games. I immediately went to what does Blizzard think of this, though?
And yeah.
I can't imagine they're too happy about it. I'm not sure they care about Trump one way or the other, or actually I'm sure they do, but it's not in question here. I'm sure they would love for this to go away, though. I don't think they want Overwatch to be associated with this kind of thing. You know, and they could, of course, say, hey, you're using our property, please stop. But I think that would bring only negative attention to them.
It's and Barbara Streisand effect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think there were a number of PR people and Blizzard seeing this and thinking, oh my God, please make this go away. Please, we don't want this for our brand. Imagine, because A few people have mentioned it, you know, it's Overwatch, it's Hanzo, blah, blah, blah. Imagine if you start seeing on primetime news television, you know, this game, Overwatch, is, you know, Donald Trump is portrayed as Overwatch characters and Overwatch, Trump, Overwatch, Trump, Overwatch. I think that would be that no one wants this.
Yeah.
To be fair, I think they wouldn't want it with Clinton either. Obviously, she's less radioactive than Trump right now on the controversy side. Whether or not you believe that's warranted, that's just the reality of it. So yeah, I'm very curious. I would have been very curious to be in a boardroom at Blizzard when they were discussing this.
Yeah.
But yeah, interesting. Anyway. I think that is going to be it for the show. Very VR heavy, and I hope we'll get more positive VR stories in the future. There are a few games that are coming up on the PlayStation VR until the end of the year, and hopefully after that as well. So I'll keep you appraised with my impressions on the things that are coming, or if I have new experiences there. But for now, this is the end of the show. And before we leave, as usual, Ed, could you tell people where they can find you if they want more of you?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Edesis. And if you want to watch me play video games, I usually do it Monday nights, 7 o'clock. So tonight, after this podcast is posted, probably.
Yep.
And yeah, so I usually I play Overwatch. I've been playing ReCore over the past couple of days, but I might pick up an indie game. I've been playing this little game called Fury, which came out a couple months ago on PlayStation, and that's pretty cool. So if you're interested in that and you want to watch us, we play video games every single night over at 4pp.tv, and we record our podcast on Thursday nights.
Cool.
At like 9 p.m. or something like that Eastern time.
Excellent. I said we wouldn't mention it, but you played ReCore, and it's been getting very meh reviews. I tried the demo, and I was unconvinced. What did you think of that game?
I actually quite liked it.
Really?
So I think the meh reviews are weighed down by the technical aspect of it. The load times aren't great. It looks okay as far as like graphics wise, but the management of gameplay isn't too deep, but the what really makes it shine to me is these little like dungeons that you go into, which are pure platforming dungeons. So it reminds me, it harkens back to Super Mario Sunshine, where you had those really? Those dungeons that you went and you were literally just in there to traverse the world to the end and get the star, you know? And so those really, really impressed me as far as the gameplay element was. And actually at the very end, the entire end section is all platforming, with the exception of these little arenas that you land in where you're doing some fighting. But it really it's challenging, and that kind of game does not exist in the modern day. And for a $40 game, I think it's worth it.
Okay, but I thought that the energy cores were playing a huge role in that you could, you know, extract them and then put them in your companion and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Doesn't that gameplay element make it fun? You're saying that
That part. I was talking about the gameplay, I meant more like the fact that you're literally just switching your colors in order to kill enemies and stuff like that. That isn't very engaging, but the gameplay part of like leveling up your robot and infusing them with different parts and different little core things or whatever, that stuff is promising. And I think that given a chance, I think this could become a good sequel, kind of like a Watch Dogs 1 to 2 and Assassin's Creed 1 to 2 is probably the better example. Okay. So I give it a chance. If you can find it for less than $30, go for it. But I think it's worth $40 for a $40 game. I think it's worth it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And if you want more, again, at Edesis on Twitter, and you'll find the links to his stuff from there. And for me, you can find my stuff at NotPatrick on Twitter and on Facebook. And this show and the Fitness Club at FrenchSpin.com. The latest episode of the Fitness Club was a discussion with a very conservative Christian, where we discussed his views and his opinions on different things. And, you know, I was saying I like politics. What I like even more than politics itself is being able to discuss things in a respectable, you know, polite environment and not yell at each other. And that is what we tried to do there and try to explore what world he was living in a respectful manner. And I think we achieved that. So that was a nice special episode. The regular episodes where we discuss news with people from different parts of the world is coming back, of course, at the end of the month. So that's at FrenchSpin.com. And yeah, again, remember to come tell me in the comments or on Twitter what your experience with Knights of the Eternal Throne is. I would be interested to know. That's gonna be it for us, and we will be back in about 2 weeks for another episode. Thanks so much for listening, and talk to you then. Bye.